This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. From Benjamin Franklin to Donald Trump, we've always believed in America as the land of opportunity, a nation in which the children of hardworking immigrants lift themselves into the middle class and then send their kids on to college and an even better life. Last month, the Wall Street Journal began a series called Moving Up, which concluded that we are not quite as upwardly mobile as we thought. After a re-examination of data, many economists now say that people on the lowest economic rung in the United States have a worse chance of climbing the social ladder than their counterparts in Western Europe and Canada. But social mobility is a complex equation. Our society as a whole is ever more prosperous, and the most economically dynamic group in the country, recent immigrants, rarely are included in the calculations. Even so, these conclusions raise troubling issues. It turns out that your parents' status, even your grandparents', matters more than we once thought, that we're less of a meritocracy than we'd like to believe. Later in the program, mixtapes, those homemade soundtracks. Do you still make them? Thurston Moore of the art rock group Sonic Youth does, and he'll join us to say why. But first, economic mobility. Are you better off than your parents? Do you expect your kids will have a better future than you? If you've left the economic class you were born into, how? And did you move up or down? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, TOTN at NPR.org. And joining us now is David Wessel, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, one of the lead reporters on the journal series Moving Up, Challenges to the American Dream. And he's been nice enough to join us here in Studio 3A. Thanks very much for coming in.
You're welcome.
What does it mean if the economic escalator doesn't run as well as we thought?
It means that there's a difference between the myth of mobility in America and the reality. As you pointed out, Benjamin Franklin stands for this great American story that anybody can come from any class and become president of the United States or wealthy. After all, Franklin started out penniless and was so rich that he could retire to diplomacy and politics at age 42. America still delivers that on that myth for many people, but it doesn't do it for as many people as we used to think. And I think that's interesting because it allows, it may inform our politics. It may explain why Americans have tolerated a society that has become increasingly unequal over the last 35 years.
There's been a growing divide between the very rich and the very poor, but most people thought Americans thought that was okay as long as they thought they too had a chance at the brass ring.
They or their children, yes.
Yeah. And that is less true than we thought.
Yes. It's important to say it's not getting, from what my reading of the data, it's not getting worse. That's not the point of our series. Our point is that it's not getting better, and that's a problem at a time when the distance from the economic cellar to the economic penthouse is rising. And it requires some thought about what are the escalators of social mobility, which ones do we want to do something about, which ones do we have to accept as facts of life, and which ones are operating in so far in the background we don't even see them.
And the one that I think makes a lot of Americans uncomfortable is the legacy that we get from our parents, beyond whatever money we may inherit. The idea that we're born into their whatever group we're born into, whatever group they were in when we were born, that's the group that we're going to get the benefit or the lack of benefit from that.
Right. Sandy Jenks, who's a sociologist at Harvard, pointed out to me that nobody is comfortable with a society in which the only thing that matters is who your parents are. Mm-hmm. We're not happy with a kind of old caricature of Europe where you were permanently in the working class or permanently in the royalty. But we're also not comfortable with a society where it makes no difference. Because after all, we want parents to spend time, energy, inspiration, even their money on their kids. And if we don't give them some incentive to do that, they won't do it. So the question is, where in the middle is the right balance? I don't know the answer to that, but that's the way I like to think of the question. How much are we willing to say it's okay if you do well because your parents gave you a lot of stuff? And how much are we want to say that we want to try and make the game more fair, so that if you happen to be born to a single mom in a poor part of Philadelphia or Los Angeles, you too have a shot at going to a good college and getting a middle-class job.
We're talking about America's economic escalator. Our guest is David Wessel of the Wall Street Journal. If you'd like to join us, our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And let's talk with Monica. Monica's calling from Milford, Indiana.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment would be, I think it does make a difference, actually, what kind of a background you're raised in, whether it be lower class, middle class, whatever. My mother was divorced, and, she was raising two girls, and she had no extras. Well, now I'm married, and we have four children, and my husband, on a good year, will make maybe $45,000.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a stay-at-home mother. I have my own garden. I can all my own fruit. We butcher our own beef, our own hogs. I realize that there's people that can't do that. But I think it makes a difference how accepting we are of the situation that we're in, and also how we manage what we do have. In fact, my husband is actually the one that taught me how to manage, because he grew up in a very conservative home where the children gave their money home to the parents when they worked away until they were a certain age.
Mm-hmm.
And it helped them to learn how to manage their money correctly. And we're really not wanting for anything. We have a new home in 2000, and we have a mortgage. We have used vehicles. No, we will not go out and buy brand new SUVs, $3,000 vehicle that we cashed off. We don't need that prestige of having this $30,000 SUV. And I think that makes a big difference sometimes in how fast we can move up.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that would be my comment. And my question would be, do you think that sometimes we don't make it so much as this credit card? I get like 6 or 7 credit card mailings in the mail every day, and I'm just continuously running them through the shredder. And I wonder how many people actually take advantage of all these, and I think that's a detriment.
Mm-hmm. Monica, before we let you go, let me ask you a question, and we'll get an answer to your question. But do you expect your children to do better than you're doing?
Well, you know what? I think... How do I describe that? You know what? I think I'm very happy where I'm at, and if my children can reach where I am at right now, I would be satisfied with that. And if they choose to go further, then that would be up to them.
So as your question about credit cards indicates, you're not talking strictly about monetary achievements. All right. David Wessel, let's get an answer to that question.
There are two important things to remember. One is that our kids will probably do better than we do on average, because America is a growing country with a rising standard of living. And that's one way to think about the question. The other is to think about how we divide the slices of the pie of that prosperity, and that's where the mobility issues come in. I think the caller is absolutely right to pick up on the question of debt. One of my colleagues, Bob Davis, did a story in our series that looked just at that and observed that there are a lot of people in America who want to have more stuff, more goods and services, better trips and so forth than their parents did, don't have the income to do it, but are able to an extraordinary degree in America today to borrow, to buy that stuff, and many of them do get into trouble, and it's good reason to worry about it. His piece was set in Utah, and the lead example was a guy whose name was Benjamin Franklin Bagot, who was named by his father, who was an admirer for Benjamin Franklin, and gave him all that stuff that Franklin talked about thrift, and then promptly proceeded to ignore it all.
Yeah, that thrift part turns out to matter. Monica, good luck. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. As we mentioned earlier, not long ago, most economists believed the U.S. was an economically mobile society. Some began to rethink that conventional wisdom. To help us understand, we turn to Gary Solon, a professor of economics at the University of Michigan. He's with us by phone from his office in Ann Arbor. Nice of you to be with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
As I understand it, there are two basic long-running studies that economists turn to for this information. What did they get wrong?
Oh, well, where we went wrong, it was really both economists and sociologists, was before we had access to these new, better data sets. Until about 15 years ago, it was very, very difficult to get any data on incomes of both generations from the same family. So researchers were sort of forced to work with whatever they could get, and what they could get wasn't very good. They were odd data sets with not such good measurement of income and on very unrepresentative samples. And we've come to understand since then that the data deficiencies led systematically to underestimation of how strong the link is between parents' income and children's income. And what helped us figure this out was much better data sets. One of those, as a Michigan prof, I'm proud to say, is a University of Michigan survey called the Panel Study of Income Dynamics, which since the late 1960s has been following a national probability sample of thousands of American families and going back to them year after year and asking them, well, how much money did you make last year, along with a battery of many other questions. And in addition to having pretty good income measures from this year after year on the same folks, this survey has followed the kids from the original families as they've grown up to become adults and form their own households, so that for some years now there has been an intergenerational span to the data set, so that we're able to look at how strong is the relationship between the kids' incomes and the incomes of their parents. Around the same time, in the late 60s, there was also another data set, fairly similar, although different in certain respects, called the National Longitudinal Surveys of Labor Market Experience. Interestingly, it's partly operated by Ohio State. So Michigan and Ohio State are competing in the intergenerational data field as well as the football field. And quite a bit of the research has been done with that data set also. And these data sets have given us a lot better information, first because they're working with nationally representative samples, and secondly, because they're so-called longitudinal surveys, which go back and collect the income information repeatedly over the years, we now have a much better handle on the longer-run income of the people in those surveys.
Well, hang with us. We'll get to what that means when we get to more of our calls from our listeners. And the question again is, are you doing better than your parents did? Do you expect your children to do better than you did? Is the engine, the economic escalator in America, is it working for you and your family? Has it stuttered? Our number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, the email address, totn@npr.org. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about economic mobility in American society. On new data, economists have downgraded Horatio Alger's American Dream. It turns out, well, if you've read those books, you know this too, the social ladder has always been hard to climb. What's your experience? Are you better or worse off than your parents? If you're an immigrant or the child of immigrants, have you made it to the ranks of the middle class? What did it take? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest in Studio 3A is David Wessel, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, one of the lead reporters on the journal series Moving Up, Challenges to the American Dream. And still with us is Gary Solon, a professor of economics at the University of Michigan. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Ken. Ken's with us from Owensboro, Kentucky.
Yeah, I was listening to you. It was interesting when he mentioned legacy, because when you posed the question, I'm a much better off now than my parents. And I come from a divorced mama in the 60s. She was a single parent before it became fashionable. But I think part of the issue is, too, when you look at family legacy, is I started at the bottom rung of the ladder and was able to climb to the top, shall we say. And since I'm so high, will my kids be better off than me? I'm not sure that that's going to be all that easy for them. I think the legacy I left them is that I hope they at least break even and stay at the same level.
Okay, Ken. Again, your phone's breaking up, so I'm gonna let you go. But I think we got your point. Appreciate the phone call.
Sure.
Did you run across that in as you talk to people around the country, David?
I think that as I said earlier, there's two different ways to think about this. One is, will our kids live better than we do depends a lot on what happens to the whole level of living standards in the United States. And There's always a surprising amount of doubt in America about that, but the evidence is, given what's happened to productivity and wages over time, that our kids, on average, will live better than other people, than we did. It is, of course, true that if you're at the top, your kids have nowhere to go but down. The facts are, though, that not a lot of kids fall out of that top tier into the bottom. Maybe Gary can shed some light on that, but I don't think there's there's surprisingly little of that as I look at the data.
They may not fall to the bottom, but Gary Sullen, do they fall to the middle sometimes?
Well, on average, they'll go somewhat in that direction. As David's been reporting in a series of articles, one thing we academic researchers have been finding is that the connection between parents' relative income status and kids' relative income status when they grow up is stronger than we used to realize. But another thing we've looked at, which I think he was just referring to, is whether there's any asymmetry in that. That is, whether rags to riches is more or less common than riches to rags. And there seems to be some indication in the data, not just in the United States, but in some other countries as well, that riches to rags is less common. In a sense, there's in some way a fairly well-developed safety net for the offspring of the rich. It's pretty unusual for them to fall a huge amount.
Here's an email question from Bradford in Portland, Oregon. Why does the U.S. still have the reputation for its so-called American dream? Social and economic mobility is considerably easier in countries that combine a market economy as well as a robust social safety net. Why have we allowed allegedly stagnant old European countries to outpace us in these areas? Is that comparison to old Europe, if you will? Is that accurate, Gary Sullen?
As we've started to get good intergenerational income data from other countries, one of the maybe surprising and maybe not so surprising findings is that the connection between the generations and relative income status is relatively high in the United States compared to many other developed countries. Maybe that shouldn't be so surprising because it's been apparent for a long time that there's relatively high income inequality in the United States, and these two things do tend to go together.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bradford started off by asking why do we even have this belief that this is a highly mobile society, relatively speaking? And I think, Neil, you mentioned what's probably a reason for that, which is immigration. The statistical evidence we're talking about relating income between generations is about families where the parents were already in the United States. And this in no way denies that when somebody immigrates to America from a very poor country where they were poor and were probably going to stay poor, they're doing it in the hope of having a better economic level of living in the United States. And in many cases, their hopes are realized to some extent for themselves and probably often for their children also. So I think the idea of America as the land of opportunity is very tied up with the immigrant experience, and that's a valid aspect of thinking of America as a land of opportunity.
Well, Gary Sullen, we're going to explore that with somebody else in a moment, but thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
Gary Sullen, professor of economics at the University of Michigan, and he joined us from his office in Ann Arbor. Joining us now is Roberto Suro, director of the Pew Hispanic Center. He's with us by phone from Ronald Reagan National Airport right across the river in Virginia. Nice of you to be with us today.
Good to be with you.
And you're the group that has been measuring economic mobility amongst immigrants, but it's a difficult thing to measure.
Because you have to measure it over time, and it takes a while for any immigrant to catch up because of lack of familiarity with the labor markets and lack of familiarity with the language. And then there are characteristics, particularly among Hispanic immigrants, that land them at the bottom of the labor force, particularly their lack of education.
Now, of course, you mentioned the largest and newest immigrants. Many of them are Latinos. What do we know about first-generation success compared to the second and so on?
Well, we really only have two generations to look at in the current wave of immigration that began in the 1970s and 80s. the third generation, the people who trace their roots here as far back as their grandparents or more, really came before this big run-up, which really has accelerated in the last 10 years. And so we know that it can often take 20 years for an immigrant to catch up to the level of native-born who have the same levels of education, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And the early returns are that the second generation does significantly better than the first, but you would expect that because we're talking about people who were born here. They don't have immigration issues. They speak English as a native language, and they're the products of U.S. schools. But they don't do all that well, at least in the early returns. There's a widespread, and there are a lot of second-generation Latinos who are sort of on the front edge of a big cohort that's still very young. But the front edge there are a great many who are ending up at the low end of the labor force.
And have not found ways for them or their children to move ahead.
That's right. I mean, which is not to say that there aren't a lot of success stories, because there are. And there are people who are ending up in the middle. But it's the U.S. labor force is very bifurcated now between people who've got a college education or more and those who don't.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very hard to jump from one side to the other of that educational divide.
Thanks very much, Roberto. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank
Roberto,
you.
Roberto Sura, have a good flight.
Thank you very much.
Roberto Sura, director of the Pew Hispanic Center, and he joined us by phone from Ronald Reagan Airport in Northern Virginia. And David Wessel, reading some of the stuff in your series, you do run across the difficulty of trying to figure out what this huge group of immigrants is doing in this country and how it would affect the economic escalator. But you do see indicators, if you will, that the graduating class at the University of California at Berkeley, half the students had both parents born somewhere else.
Right. I think we do know a few things and we don't know a lot of things. One thing we know is that millions of immigrants prefer the United States to their home country. And it looks like, despite all that we've been through, 9/11, the war in Iraq and everything, that an awful lot of immigrants, if they had a choice, would come here rather than go to some other country. So that tells you these immigrants are very much in touch with their relatives and friends who've come already. So they may expect the streets to be paved with gold and not find them, but they choose to come here, and that tells us something about our society. Then the second question is the one that Roberto was talking about is, so is their experience here as Americans similar to the experience of people who were born in this country like I was? And there, because it takes so long to get a good set of numbers that shows parents and children, even grandparents and grandchildren, it's really hard to tell, and it clearly, clearly differs by ethnic group. We have lots of evidence of how successful some Asians are in the U.S., but you wouldn't want to generalize to that for all immigrants who come to the United States. So we all have this intuitive sense that there are a lot of immigrants climbing the ladder. We all have this intuitive sense that there are a lot of immigrants, particularly those who don't speak English, who have darker skins, that are not somehow able to find the escalator, and we're trying to figure out which one is the predominant story.
Let's get another caller on the line. Let's go to Jeff. Jeff's calling from Detroit.
Yes, hi. Well, I just wanted to add some comments regarding what you guys have been saying. I'm French here. I moved to Detroit. I've been here for 5 months. I got my engineering degree in France, and I've always been a very conservative French person. Always wanted to stay there, never leave the country. But at some point with my degree, I had a very hard time finding an interesting job in France. And, you know, by pure coincidence, I just applied for the U.S. and I got a job extremely rapidly. And I just noticed to which extent this country is extremely dynamic, with a very dynamic market, with a very motivated workforce. And I have reached a position that I never would have dreamed of back in France, even though France remains a very developed country.
In 5 months in this country.
Indeed. And I applied to my employer here 5 months. So I moved after I was hired, but I got an excellent position I wouldn't have got with 15 years of experience in France.
And you sound young enough, Jeff, that you don't necessarily have to worry that if you lose your job, you might not have health insurance coverage or much unemployment insurance.
Well, the thing is, I'm not really worrying about it, maybe because I'm young, too. I just got into the workforce. But no, I'm not really worried about it. I mean, this country, just seeing the amount of opportunities, losing my job here, isn't really worrying me, for I'm always thinking I can always find something just as easily, maybe. Well, maybe it was the lucky shot, but I just wanted to add that this country is really extraordinary regarding its market, the way people are desperately searching for talent.
Well, there's a Benjamin Franklin for you.
Right, and I think that one of the things we know is that for all the problems of the U.S. economy today, two things stand out. One is the dynamism that he refers to. I mean, like it or not, we're dynamic. Sometimes you're on the losing end of the dynamic. And the other thing is that having skills and education in the U.S. is a real necessity. That immigrants who come here and who don't speak English and don't have much education are competing with lots of other people like them and a lot of native-born Americans for jobs that simply don't pay very well. And there's a lot more people there than there are jobs. But at the top end, the kind of engineer like the French fellow who just phoned in,
Jeff,
there's still an enormous demand. Despite all the stories about outsourcing to India and China and all that, there's still an enormous demand for these skilled workers.
Jeff, bonne chance. Appreciate the phone call. Thanks very much. We're talking with David Wessel of the Wall Street Journal about his series, Moving Up, Challenges to the American Dream. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email from Kieran Dooley in Cleveland. I'm still middle class, like my parents. However, middle class has improved from a generation ago. So class inflation exists. My middle class parents would never have expected to travel so much and have multiple cars and retire healthy and comfortable as I do. Those expectations were reserved for the wealthy 50 years ago. What do you think about the idea of class inflation?
I think it's absolutely true that the standard of living in the United States today in 2005 is much better than it was in 1955, and for most people, much better than it was in 1975. If you live at the middle of the middle class, particularly beginning about the mid-90s, things really started to get better. And there's no arguing that. It's clear that there was, during the 70s and 80s, some kind of stalling in that progress as productivity growth slowed, as more people had to have two spouses in the workforce to have the kind of lifestyle that one of their parents managed to deliver. But when you think about health care and air quality and the devices that we have and the trips we can take and the deregulation of airlines allowing us to fly to Disneyland, which didn't even exist in 1950, there's no denying that. That's one question and that's one answer. That doesn't tell you that the game is being played fairly and that black kids growing up in inner city Detroit have the same chances for success as upper middle class white kids in Bethesda, Maryland. And it's important to ask both questions, not just one of them.
And you mentioned race. Education obviously is another factor. And the other predictor is what your parents made and how they did.
How much money they had. If they went to college, you're much more likely to go to college. I mean, Larry Summers, the president of Harvard, is giving a lot of speeches about this, and one of the points he makes that at selective institutions like Harvard, only 10% of the only 10% of the students come from the bottom half of the income scale. And that's just and going to Harvard or college like that is an important way that people pass along the status to their kids.
Let's see if we get one more caller in. Ford. Ford's with us from Trumansburg in New York. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Go ahead, then.
Hi. I think that one of the questions that we're asking is kind of the wrong question. My wife and I, when we started, were off to a very good financial beginning, and we got way ahead of where our parents would have been. And then we reevaluated our life and realized that, the pursuit of wealth was not... We kind of slowed down our pace. We have a very happy, a very comfortable life. We're going to stay in the middle class. I mean, we're not going to move beyond that, and we're not disturbed by that at all.
So the pursuit of wealth not equal to the pursuit of happiness?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it's a valid question to say that with the rising standard of living, is it necessary to have this increased wealth when the standard of living has raised anyway?
David?
Well, I think it's a very good point that money doesn't buy happiness, but it does help, and it's one thing to make a choice that you want to live a simpler lifestyle with less material goods because you've opted not to do it. And it's another thing to be a welfare mom struggling to get by and wishing you could move up and not being able to. So whether you choose to do it or whether you're forced to do it, it seems to me is a pretty big issue.
Ford, thanks and good luck.
Well, thank you very much.
Appreciate the phone call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
David Wessel, we appreciate your time today as well. It's an interesting series.
Thank you.
David Wessel, Deputy Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, one of the lead reporters on the Journal series, Moving Up, Challenges to the American Dream, and he was kind enough to join us here in Studio 3A. When we come back from our break, Sonic Youth's Thurston Moore wants you to fire up the stereo plus record play and mix up your tapes. If you've ever made a mixtape, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, totn@npr.org. Who did you make the tape for, and what was the message? Back after the break, I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.